And now it's time for On Our Minds. Neuroscientist Sam Harris is best known as the guy who helped launch the new atheist movement. His first book, The End of Faith, was a fierce attack on organized religion, so it's kind of a shock to see the title of his new book. It's called Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. Steve Paulson wanted to know why Sam Harris would write a book in favor of a spiritual life.
Sam, you are a very prominent atheist, so it's going to surprise a lot of people that you've written a book about spirituality. I mean, a lot of atheists and humanists despise that word. They consider any talk about spirituality as an invitation to mushy thinking. Do you see that as a problem?
Yeah, I do, because as you say, atheists have an association with this term that deems it more or less synonymous with a belief in a soul that can survive brain death or ghosts and etc. Ironically, some of the more prominent atheists have used the term spirituality without much apology. People like Christopher Hitchens and Carl Sagan, they didn't use it in my sense, but they both used it to describe experiences of meaning or beauty that they found too potent for ordinary terms, like the view through the Hubble Deep Field image. I don't actually use spirituality in that sense because I think that is somewhat misleading. I would like to reserve the term for the efforts that people can make to deeply transform their moment-to-moment experience of the world through disciplined techniques of introspection like meditation.
But you're saying that there's something missing in everyone's life, atheist or not, if they don't have some sense of the spiritual in their own lives?
Yeah, well, I think there's deeply transformative experiences of, for instance, unconditional love. You know, if you wake up tomorrow morning feeling more love than you ever have for anybody, for all of humanity, for whatever reason, you've got knocked on the head or you have been on a meditation retreat or you took MDMA, I mean, something has perturbed your nervous system, and now you are open to a fundamentally different perception of yourself and the world. And unfortunately, there's almost no place in our culture, there really is no place in our culture where you can have that experience apart from one or another Iron Age religion or New Age cult. And that's a problem for the forces of reason because people have these experiences. They are often, very often, the most important experiences they ever have in their lives. And we atheists have more or less deemed them inadmissible.
And yet there's a whole category of people who call themselves spiritual but not religious. I mean, you know, in surveys, that's actually a fairly large percentage of how people now define themselves. You seem to be part of that group in a way.
Yeah. Depending on how the question gets asked, it's about 20%. And clearly, there are some problems there because much of what people believe in the name of spirituality is as dogmatic and as superstitious as what other people believe in the name of religion. And so that's really the basis for the atheist or skeptical reaction against this term. At the core of these experiences, I argue, is the phenomenon of self-transcendence, the fact that the self that we think we all have, the sense of I, the sense of me behind my eyes, looking out at the world that's other than what I am, that can be cut through. That is, there's an experience of self-transcendence, which is the loss of that feeling of separateness. And that really lies at the core of many religious traditions. And that really is the center of the bullseye for spirituality.
Now, I was surprised to hear that you've wanted to write this book for years. I mean, this gets very personal for you, right?
Yeah. Well, before I became a noted atheist, I was someone who was deeply interested in experiences of this kind. I spent about 2 years on silent meditation retreats in my 20s, mostly in a Buddhist context, but not exclusively.
And this is where you would sometimes meditate for, what, 12 or even 18 hours a day?
Yeah. Most of these were Vipassana retreats, which the principal export of which is now this concept of mindfulness, which you see very much in vogue now in the West. The better you get at this, the more you begin to see that this sense of there being a center to experience, the sense that there's a thinker who is thinking the thoughts or a hearer who's hearing sounds, that begins to break down. And it can break down in a way that really is decisive, where it is absolutely clear that the sense of I has dropped away.
Now, what you haven't said is that it led to experiences of rapture, of ecstasy. I mean, those kinds of peak experiences that some people say happens when they have an experience of enlightenment.
Yeah, well, it does. It does. But those experiences are never the point. And now it can be hard to understand this when you're having those experiences. So in your...
So you've had those experiences.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I've had those experiences with and without the benefit of pharmacology. So there's a chapter in the book on psychedelics. And you've
sampled quite a number, right? I mean, from ecstasy to psilocybin and LSD.
Yeah, yeah. And a number of times of each.
Were those psychedelic experiences formative for you?
Well, they were in the sense that they advertised to me in a very startling and unequivocal way that it was possible to have a very different experience of life. And I was a sufficiently lumpen character that I needed that kind of sledgehammer blow to convince me that there was something worth paying attention to in the nature of my own mind. People have to read my book or my blog to know the full story here, because I can't recommend them totally without caveat, because obviously there are dangers with any drugs. But the unique power of psychedelics is that something is guaranteed to happen. I mean, boredom is just simply not on the table. And so if you take 100 micrograms of LSD, something is going to change about your experience. Now, it can be a terrifying change, and in some cases it is. But if it's a positive change, it will be a change of a sort that convinces you that it's possible to be far more at ease in the universe and in your life and with other people than you've tended to be. Because this is the problem with meditation or any other more subtle technique of spiritual practice. There's no guarantee it's going to work for you.
It's hard work, too.
Yeah, it's hard work, and some people have an aptitude for it, some people don't. Now, the chief obstacle to meditation, really any style of meditation, is the fact that we are lost in thought virtually every second of our waking lives. We're just thinking since the moment we get out of bed in the morning, and we don't notice it. So the enemy of wisdom, the enemy of noticing what you want to notice, is distraction and thought.
You know what I find fascinating about what you're saying is, I mean, to some degree, you're talking about getting rid of your thoughts during contemplative practice, and yet you live through your thinking. I mean, you know, you're a widely recognized public intellectual, you know, with an incisive, critical mind. I mean, thinking is your bread and butter. How do you square these two sides of your life?
Well, it's not so much getting rid of thoughts. It's no longer being identified with thought. It's recognizing thought, as it arises in consciousness. And if you're anything like me, most of your thoughts are unhappy thoughts. I mean, but there's probably some lucky listeners out there who think happy thoughts all day long, and for whom, you know, much of this isn't going to make sense because they're just satisfied with their lives and they love everybody and they see no benefit to getting out of the prison of thought. But for most of us, thinking is like being kidnapped by the most boring person on earth and being told the same story over and over again. I mean, if you can imagine if your thoughts were broadcast on a monitor for other people to hear. I mean, you tell
God
yourself
forbid.
The same.
Yeah.
Yeah. You repeat the same anecdote, the same incident, 15 different ways. If other people could hear this or see these images, you would seem completely insane. And yet, it's because it's in the privacy of our own mind, we think this is completely normal. Now, it begins not to seem normal when you discover an alternative, which is you can actually just break the spell. You can cease to be lost in this negative dream. The sooner you can break the spell, the sooner you have a choice between being the angry guy or the person who's over it.
We are almost out of time, but there's one last question I want to ask you. Near the end of the book, you say, spirituality remains the great whole in secularism, humanism, rationalism, atheism. Are you saying that the atheist movement is ready for the next stage to figure out how to fill that hole?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, this comes down to the question of what will replace religion. And I think something has to replace religion because we have to get out of our tribal affiliations. We have to make the basis for religious conflict unthinkable. And the way to do that is to capture everything people think they need out of religion in some other form. And much of that's happening anyway in art and literature and entertainment and the rest of culture. You know, you don't need religion to give you community. You don't need religion to be moral. The one missing piece for many people is these kinds of experiences. We're all playing this game. It's just few of us actually recognize the structure of the game. And when you do recognize the structure, that you're just trying to get back to the present moment and find a reason enough to be happy here, then that gives you a reason to train your mind explicitly to pay attention to the present moment differently.
We need to leave it there. We are out of time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Sam Harris talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. They actually had a longer conversation that ranged from the nature of consciousness to near-death experiences. You can hear it on our website at ttbook.org. While you're there, we also just reposted our conversations with filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer and cartoonist Alison Bechdel. They're on our minds this week because they both just won MacArthur Genius Awards.